It's our favorite book, Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1. Chapter 10 is where I'm reading from. And chapter 10, reading two verses. And they fit very nicely together. If I didn't tell you what the storyline is, you might not even imagine it to be what it is. The scene is Krishna's leaving, going back through chapters 8 and 9, Krishna tried to leave and Uttara stopped him. Krishna tried to leave again and Kunti stopped him. Krishna tried to leave again and Yudhisthira stopped him. When Yudhisthira stopped him, it was very effective. Krishna stayed for 3 months. When Kunti tried to stop him, he just smiled. Got on the chariot and was ready to go. But Yudhisthira persuaded Krishna to stay, and primarily for two reasons mentioned, to pacify Yudhisthira and to pacify Subhadra. Because Subhadra was Krishna's sister, and Subhadra was one of the wives of Arjun, and her only son had been killed in the battle. And the posthumous son of her son, Maharaj Parikshit, was yet to be born when Krishna was leaving. So he stayed to pacify Subhadra, and he stayed to pacify Yudhisthira. But by Krishna's arrangement, he was unable to pacify Yudhisthira, so Bhishmadev pacified Yudhisthira. And chapter 9 is that. And then Bhishmadev's instructions to Yudhisthira about how to rule, and Bhishmadev passes, and chapter 10 begins Yudhisthira's ruling. And the glories of having a qualified king, and Prabhupada takes ample opportunity to describe what happens when you don't have a qualified king, or you don't even have kings, you have the other type. Mucho problema, as they say in Spanish. Many problems. So he describes that, and so the kingdom is rivaling in opulence the king of heaven. So Krishna is ready to leave. And there's no checking Krishna this time. So the scene is separation. The phrase that's used repeatedly is viraha, or vipralamba is another term. The mood of love and separation from Krishna. And it's stirring the hearts of the different residents of Hastinapur, some of whom, many of whom are related to him, some of whom had actually never even seen him before, but they heard about him. That's the scene of, so he leaves the palace, he leaves the main assembly area outside the palace, and he's on his chariot, he's rolling. And two divisions of Akshohini, divisions of elephants and chariots and big production and buglers and musicians and trumpet players and drum players and brahmanas reciting Vedic prayers, and oh, it's a big to do. So as he's going along further, there's ladies up on rooftops, and they had like Rukmini, who had never seen Krishna. They had never seen Krishna. But now they're seeing Krishna. And they're excited. And in their excitement, they're describing the glories of Krishna. And Sutta says, Krishna was more pleased by their words than the sacred hymns of the Vedas being chanted by the Brahmanas. And he gives two reasons why. They were chanting with great feeling, of great affection. And the other is, it was very personal, whereas the hymns of the Vedas are sometimes indirect, and therefore indicating in the direction of Krishna, but not so as personal. Krishna was very pleased with their prayers, and so that's the section, they're reading their prayers. The two verses we're reading this evening go very nicely together. The queens are saying, oh dear friends, here is that very same personality of Godhead whose attractive and confidential pastimes are described in the confidential parts of the Vedic literature by his great devotees. So it's similar to the Brahmanas. The Brahmanas are reciting hymns from the Samaveda and Rig Veda and the other Vedas, and largely those hymns are indicating indirectly, or at best they're differentiating between the mundane and the spiritual. Prabhupada writes, in the Vedanta Sutras or Upanishads, there's only a hint of the confidential parts of his pastimes. In such Vedic literatures as the Upanishads, the Lord has expressly been distinguished from the mundane conception of his existence. So, elaborately distinguishing in a pronoun that, tat. So they take that to be impersonal. The supreme is that, the pronoun. But the confidential, so the Sanskrit is Vedeshu Guyeshu, the confidential portion of the Vedic literatures, Cha Guya Vadivi, so Guya is there twice, the confidential literatures presented by the confidential devotees disclose his personality. And here he is. Of course, here he is the same one that's described in the indirectly by the Vedic hymns, but directly by the confidential portion of the Vedic literature. And who is this person? It is he only who creates, maintains, and annihilates the material world. Like, imagine you see somebody walking down the road. Oh, there's the person who creates, maintains, and annihilates the whole creation. There he is. It's not just, you know, somebody who, you know, in charge of Microsoft. There he is. Or the guy that's in charge of something else. The President of the United States. The one who won the World Cup, the one who won the World Series, the one who created the whole and maintains it and withdraws it unto him. There he is. And although we haven't seen, we've heard from the scriptures, the confidential pastimes, that's him, the very same person. Oh dear friends, here is that very same personality of Godhead. And he performs these wonderful pastimes, and yet he also creates that place which into which he comes to perform his pastimes, the material world. And when he comes, he remains unaffected. Sajjate is the word that's used. It becomes attached to. And na tatra sajjate. He's unaffected. So then the next verse is, why does he come? If he's he creates the place and comes and performs pastimes, he's unaffected by it. Why does he come? Text 25. Whenever there are kings and administrators living like animals in the lowest modes of existence, the Lord in His transcendental form manifests His supreme power and caps the truth positive. He shows special mercy to the faithful, performs wonderful activities, and manifests various transcendental forms as is necessary in different periods and ages. So one might think Prabhupada is going to go down the path, which he doesn't, of paralleling this verse with Pritranaya Sadhanam Vinashaya Chaduskritam Dharmasang Stapanarthaya. He doesn't. He goes back to the previous verse, fantastic purport, where he says, as mentioned above, previous verse, the Lord creates everything. So since He creates everything, it's from His energy. It's not like He takes somebody else's energy and puts something together, and so then it becomes His, like a carpenter. Or, you know, they make the table. It's my table, it's my product, and I'm going to sell it for this much. That's called capitalism. This is God communism. The energy is His energy. And He gives Brahma the post and the ability to put it all together and make a universe. And a bunch of Brahmas make a bunch of universes. And it's all His property. It's His energy and His ability and His strength, His plan, His intelligence. And they know it. So every square inch of it is His. He said, it's beautiful. The basic philosophy of Isha Upanishad is this. Everything is the property of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. What's the verse from Isha Upanishad? Isavasham idam sarvam. Jatkincha jagat yam jagat tena tyaktena bunjita magritaha kasya svidhanam. One who understands that can go on happily living. Long, 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 happy life. No one should encroach upon the property of the Supreme Lord. One should accept only that which is kindly awarded by Him. He's just paraphrasing that first verse, text 1 of Isha Upanishad. Therefore, the earth, or any other planet or universe, is the absolute property of the Lord. Okay, now where do you go with that? The living beings, parts and parcels, or suns. And thus, every one of them has the right to live at the mercy of the Lord and execute His prescribed work. Follows very logically. And you go the other direction. No one, therefore, can encroach upon the right of another individual man or animal, because they're also praja, without being so sanctioned by the Lord. What's a king's duty? To uphold that. Everyone has a right. They have a duty. What's a king's duty is to see that everyone, on the one hand, they're entitled. And the other hand, that they're doing what they're entitled to do. the king or the administrator, in case he's not a king, is the representative of the Lord to look after managing of the Lord's will. So it's the Lord's property, and he's representing the Lord to manage his property. Right? Like, you know, the owner and the proprietor and the manager, general manager. That's what a king is. And who decides, you know, the policies? The proprietor, not the general manager. And the king is supposed to know, A, this is the proprietor's property, and B, these are the policies he wants. And I'm sold out to the proprietor. I don't have two pockets. Like, you know, my pocket and his pocket. When he's not looking, some stuff goes into my pocket. It's only one pocket, it's his. He must, therefore, be a recognized person like Maharaj Yudhisthira or Prikshit. Prabhupada comments when, after the Kurukshetra battle, yeah, to the beginning of this 10th chapter, at the beginning, at the end of the Kurukshetra battle, and all the funerals are done, and he's ready to assume the throne, he goes to two people. He goes to Dhritarashtra. And says, well, you're the king. Would you like to rule, or would you like me to rule? No. You should rule. You've actually inherited the throne. You should rule. He didn't like, okay, you know, you lost. I'm in charge. He went and verbally spoke to, submitted himself to Prabhupada, explains like this. And asked Dhritarashtra, what would you like? You're my father's elder brother. What would you like? Would you like to rule the kingdom, or would you like me to rule the kingdom? He got his blessing. Then he went to Krishna. Because although he became the king by strength, the strength of their battle, it's not just by strength of battle, it's by blessing. Because the king is to be the representative of God. And if he's not in that consciousness, he's not going to rule that way. Like Duryodhan. That was part of Yudhisthira's concern or lamentation. Duryodhan's doing a good job. What's the problem? Everything's running smoothly. But he didn't have blessing, not at all. He was, you know, far from blessing. Krishna wanted him out. And why did Krishna want him out? He was doing a good job. Because he didn't rule by religious principle, he ruled by so-called material competence. And minus religious principle, what's going to happen? Over time, things will deteriorate. That which looks good today is tomorrow going to be deteriorated without religious principle. Krishna knows that. He wanted him out. I can't leave this world and leave that guy in charge of the world. I came to relieve the world of such situation. I want pure devotee in charge of the world. So Maharaj Yudhisthira could expertly rule the kingdom, but more than expertly rule the kingdom, because beginning of this 10th chapter described, because of his piety, there was abundance of everything. The rivers and the minerals and the jewels and the trees and the rain. Because of his piety. Because of his piety, the people were following him. They were pious. Because of his surrender, Krishna was pleased and everything was bountifully supplied. So the people were taken care of, and their progressive march was being looked after. So back to what's the king is the representative of God. And what's his program? Seeing that that which is God's property is looked after properly, and the people who are populating the planet, they have their right, just like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, karma nivadikara se mapalesha kadasya, you're entitled to perform your prescribed duty. And the king is to see that they're entitled to, but they're not entitled to take the fruits of their work. Oh. No capitalism? No false ego? I did it. I deserve it. No. It goes to Krishna. By means of sacrifice, it's Krishna's property. Such kings have full responsibility and capability, knowledge from authorities about the administration of the world. Okay, now we'll go the other direction. What if the kings don't have, if they're not responsible? And they don't have that capability. They don't have even a clue. They speak about God, but they do what they want. Make up laws and do things, and not according to the codes given by God, according to their idea of whatever their idea is. That's going on. Tumblegoon. At times, due to the influence of ignorance and the mode of material nature, tamogun, the lowest of the material modes, kings and administrators come into power without knowledge and without responsibility. And such foolish administrators live like animals for the sake of their own personal interest. The result is that the whole atmosphere becomes surcharged with anarchy and vicious elements. Read the newspaper. Anarchy. What's next? And vicious elements. And people playing all these big games. Like they're, you know, playing a monopoly on a board and they roll the dice and see, you know. They don't know what they're doing. They're not a principle of some religious principle that's involved here. God's property, and we have to look after it and see that people perform. So what is it? It's vicious, anarchic, nepotism, bribery, cheating, aggression, all over the place, aggression. And therefore famine, epidemic, war, and similar other disturbing features become prominent in human society. So, what's a nice devotee supposed to think about all of that? Prabhupada says, the devotees of the Lord, or the faithful, are persecuted. By all means, these are the symptoms that indicate the time of an incarnation of the Lord to reestablish the principles of religion and vanquish the maladministrators. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita. But that's what the ladies on the rooftops are saying. This person that's on his chariot over there, and by his side is Yudhisthira with his two divisions of infantry and elephants, and he's the creator. He doesn't need divisions of soldiers. He defeats single-handedly. Jarasandha's, you know, 12 divisions of soldiers 21 times. No problem. He doesn't need... Everything comes from him and everything is withdrawn into him. He doesn't need protection. But it's Yudhisthira's way of serving him. Okay. And he comes and performs, according to the situation, he manifests forms to correct this maladministration situation. Because the kings. The Lord then appears in his transcendental form without any tinge of material qualities. He descends just to keep the state of his creation in a normal condition. The normal condition is that the Lord has provided each and every planet with all the needs of the native living beings. They can happily live and execute their predestined occupations to attain salvation at the end, following the rules and regulations mentioned in the revealed scriptures. Well, some people don't understand like that. They got another idea. Hey, look at this. It's up for grabs. It doesn't belong to anybody. I got a big pocket over here. See how much I can fit in. Oh, someone's blowing a whistle. I better run. The material world is created to satisfy the whims of the Nitya Baddha, or everlasting conditioned souls, just as naughty boys are provided with playing cradles. Do you know what a playing cradle is? I don't. What's a playing cradle? Maybe it's like, okay, you're bad, you go play over there. It's like some confined pen, or it's like you can play and not hurt anybody. Something like that, maybe? Otherwise, there's no need of the material world. But when they become intoxicated with the power of material science to exploit the resources unlawfully without the sanction of the Lord, and that also only for sense gratification, there's necessity of the Lord's incarnation to chastise the rebellious and protect the faithful. We does get into the Pritranaya Sadhanam a little bit. Then he connects this back to the previous verse again with the confidential pastimes. There he is. That in the Vedeshu Guyeshu Cha Guya Vadibi, the confidential devotees are describing in the confidential portion of the literature is that which even the Vedas rarely understands. So Krishna comes and he discloses his pastimes. When he descends, he exhibits superhuman activities just to prove his supreme right. And materialists like Ravana, Ranikashipu, and Kamsa are sufficiently punished. He acts in a manner which no one can imitate, for example, Ram's bridge. When he appears as Krishna, from his very childhood, he showed superhuman activities by killing Putana, Agasura, Shakatasura, Kali, and then his maternal uncle Kamsa. When he was at Dwarka, he married 16,108 queens, and all of them were blessed with sufficient number of children. Sum total of his personal family members amounted to 100,000. That's just his personal family. Popularly known as Yaduvamsa. And again, during his lifetime, he managed to vanquish them all. Govardhandari, Krishna at 7 years old, lifted a mountain with one hand, with the little finger of his left, not even his right hand, his left hand. Seven. Concluding, the Lord killed many undesirable kings in his time, and as Kshatriya, he fought chivalrously. So this is, he's summarizing now what the ladies on the rooftop said. He performed wonderful activities. Wonderful activities. Just suitable to the circumstance. This appearing as Nrisingadeva was to uphold the benediction of Brahma at the same time that he wouldn't be killed in land or air by this or that or this time or that time or this place, that place. So he appeared in the half man, half lion incarnation. Ranikashipu didn't ask for that one. I can't be killed by half man, half lion. Half man, half lion, not by man or beast. Not man or beast. Half man, half lion. Just suitable. Each one, Vamana. Each of the forms of the Lord. Or when he entered in the Agasura demon, he just expanded his body bigger, 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 suffocated. Or Trinavarti became heavier and heavier because he was going higher and higher and higher. Krishna became heavier and heavier. Get off me. Little boy, he couldn't get him off his head. Because he's not just a little boy. Fell to the ground, smashed in a rock slab. Or to enjoy dancing on the hoods of the Kaliya serpent. 1,001 hoods, that's a lot of dancing circles. Constantly moving circles. Very expert. So that's what they're saying. Exactly according to the circumstance. He would appear in forms and perform pastimes just to address this. When there are kings and administrators living like animals in the lowest mode of existence, and who could defeat him? He sometimes made it look like he was going to be defeated. Kaliya had him in coils for hours, and the people on the side of the Jamuna River were in such distress, they were fainting on the ground or wanting to give up their life. Let's enter into the Jamuna River and die too. If Krishna is going to die, we should die too. What's life without Krishna? So sometimes it looked like he was in difficulty and then would escape the difficulty. He was enjoying his pastimes. And the queens, and not the queens, the ladies, and specifically, although they're speaking very elevated understandings, they're not highly educated brahmanas, versed in all the Vedic science and Sanskrit. They don't have those qualifications. But they've understood very, very clearly, very wonderfully, who is Krishna. They're attached to him. From just this very process that we're doing. They're hearing and then describing. And that's our process. Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu. And by that Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu process, one's life can become perfect. What is that perfection? To know Krishna. It's not just because they're seeing Krishna, because there are others who saw Krishna. Many people, Shishupal saw Krishna. The washerman, when Krishna was entering into Mathura, he saw Krishna. And Krishna even very meekly and politely, humbly asked him for some service. Can I have some of those clothes in that bundle of clothes you're wearing, you're carrying? Oh! Be gone with you. Before the king finds out, he'll kill you. Little boys. What would you do with nice clothes like this anyway? These are the clothes of the king. But Krishna said, if you give some, it'll be very pious of you. And you'll get so much benefit, I promise you. It's true. So that he saw Krishna, but his heart was very hard and proud. I am servant of Kamsa. But others that were also the servant of Kamsa, they didn't. Kubja, she was also serving Kamsa. The washerman was washing his clothes and Kubja was bringing fragrances and scented oils. As soon as she saw Krishna, oh, this is suitable for Krishna. He anointed his forehead with sandalwood pulp and smeared his body with scented oil. Without even asking, Krishna didn't go and say, it will be pious of you if you can. Because her heart was different. when Krishna kidnapped Rukmini, so many persons saw Krishna, the kings that went chasing after him. So many situations people had to see Krishna, with the Swayamvar of Draupadi. Krishna and Balaram were both there. They didn't have a big aarti ceremony for Krishna and Balaram. It was, you know, all about Draupadi. Who's going to get Draupadi's hand? But the Pandavas knew. And Drupada knew. Because they were devotees. So, that's this hearing and chanting process is purifying when one takes to it in the proper way. And it qualifies one, even one maybe otherwise not with any special qualification, certainly not spiritual, not even material qualification. One can be qualified to know Krishna and make one's life perfect just by the hearing and chanting process.
Regarding this whole situation that you're describing, everybody is just trying to grab whatever they can. Is it the correct understanding that primarily it's happening because everybody now has the feeling that I know what's the right thing and I should answer to anybody else? And if I think this can be mine, nobody else should tell me whether this is mine or not. The reason I'm coming this way is that even in Krishna consciousness, when we come, particularly in the beginning, this whole thought that I know what is right actually stops us very strongly from surrendering to an authority or even to those who may give us some guidance. Then it looks like insoluble problem, because it's at that stage that he needs to surrender more. Because one doesn't know anything. But that's the time when one does not want to surrender.
At all times you don't want to surrender. And when this, you know, we can go along, coasting along, not surrendered, and there's some message that says, or some signal that says, or representative that says, surrender. And then, you know, it aggravates that which is already there. So, yes, we can go approach from a different angle and the misconception, the covering is ignorance. And the ignorance starts with the conception of self. So, not only we don't have the proper conception of self, we have a misconception. And with that misconception of self, it's reinforced by the conception of what is mine. They go very well together, hand and glove, I and mine. So if I could, you know, if an individual could maintain their sense of false sense of I and mine and be a nice devotee of God, that would be, wow, what a great package. But I have to let go of mine, and heaven forbid, I? Like the most important thing around here? Me? That's too much. So, let's see if we can work our way around that one. So the resistance is on that basis, a misconception, and very strongly entrenched in that misconception. So, okay, I feel more comfortable with piety. Dharma. And of course, the purpose of Dharma is artha, and the purpose of artha is kama. I'm very comfortable with that one. As long as just don't come, you know, come at me about giving up the idea that I have a misconception, and then all these things that are mine. But it has to be, because we're thieves. Excuse me, sir, but you've got your hand on somebody else's property, and you're saying you're not a thief. But I'm nice. I'm pious. You're a thief. Unless you acknowledge that it's God's property, and it's not your property. And so that's where the rub comes. Well, what's mine? And what's happiness? We have to hit the reset button, or just completely delete all the software and reinstall a whole new set of software. Keep the hard drive, that's okay, but new, different software all together. That's a lot of work. So they want to mix. Mixed devotion. And mixed devotion says, okay, in my mind I'll work with that construct, but I'm not going to actually surrender to it. We were speaking about it in class this morning, about, accepting within the mind. It's not accepting. Accepting within the mind means there's this teaching, and as much as it matches my teaching, I accept it, and the part that doesn't match my teaching, I don't accept it. I'm not accepting anything. It's just, I'm projecting my conceptions and my values on something, I say I accept it. And my values change, and, I'm not sure I accept it anymore. Or some hardship comes. So accepting Krishna consciousness from the platform of the mind is not, using your term, it's not surrender. So accepting someone's going to guide me, that someone's going to guide me, if it's the genuine thing, is going to say, no good. You got to go a little deeper. Whoa. You have to go a little deeper. So that's the resistance. Although, and it's ignorance, because although that holding on is the very source of my suffering. And nobody likes suffering. But we like to hold on to our source of suffering and not suffer. We want the kingdom of God without God. So the discussion we had this morning from the third canto was Varnashram is a beginning of human life, where it connects with this topic. The duties, the prescribed duties according to our psychophysical nature, is to connect with the fact that God's the proprietor and we're serving him according to his codes. It's laws, not even just like guidelines. We make this distinction in the governance of ISKCON. There's guidelines and there's laws. Guideline is just recommended. Laws, you must. So, laws. The kings govern according to law because it's God's property. And you can't just make up laws. Or disregard laws. There's penalty for it. The penalty that was mentioned in the purport this morning is you go down in the lower species of life. You're not entitled to have this human form of life if you can't follow the laws. That's pretty serious. So supposing I want to follow some of the laws. It's proportionate. Then we were discussing, supposing you know very well what the laws are, and consciously you don't follow them. It's different than if you don't know what the laws are. Still, you're punished if you don't know what the laws are and you break them. But if you know what the laws are and you break them, you know, premeditated murder is different than accidental. Murder is murder. But, you know, first degree, more punishable. So we shouldn't remain in ignorance, because ignorance is bliss. We should act with knowledge, and we should act responsibly. That's what this purport was speaking about. So it's a different set of rules than it's up for grabs. The rule is, it's God's property. People can be in all kinds of illusion. You know, this is there's a owner of this apartment complex, and there's like a property manager of the apartment complex, and there's a superintendent, and he's supposed to come and fix things when it breaks, and they got this all structure going on. That's okay. You should live that this is Krishna's property. And we're maintaining Krishna's property. Whether the title is in somebody else's name or your name, it's Krishna's property. So you follow the laws of the state, but your consciousness says, this is Krishna's property. The body is Krishna's property. My clothing is Krishna's property. My wife is Krishna's property. My family is it's all Krishna's. And then we follow the theistic conduct as you follow the prescribed manner. The king is supposed to see to it goes that way. You're entitled to perform your prescribed duty. No one's entitled to encroach on your right to perform your prescribed duty. That's a governmental function. And you're supposed to perform your prescribed duty. You're not your, you know, we'll hold you to task for it. But somebody tries to interfere, we'll hold them to task for it. But when that understanding is missing, as the purport is describing, it's chaos. So even in Krishna consciousness, it can be so unruly if people have within the mind accepted, which isn't really accepting, and then, you know, they've got their own set of rules of what they'll accept and not accept and play the game. But it really requires careful training. Well, careful training means not only know what the rules are and follow them, but accept on a more deep level. What we're really doing? What's going on? Why am I rising early in the morning and performing Mangal Arati? Is it just because somebody said to, and that's why I'm doing it? Any more than what we might have done when we were children. My grandmother said, and so I did. I don't know why I was doing it. My grandmother said. We should have a more deep understanding. So one can't be lazy and be Krishna conscious. One has to be thoughtful and have proper guidance. And however many times it takes, that then it's understood. And then we live from that position of understanding. And trust and surrender. Yes, even in Krishna consciousness, that this problem can exist. Anything else?
Yeah.
Confidential devotees are those that, like Arjuna is a confidential devotee. He not only knows that Krishna is God, and because Krishna is God, he surrenders. That's a devotee. But he's very confidentially associated with Krishna, so he knows in a intimate way, so many things about Krishna. So the confidential devotees are like that. They can describe details. Here's an example that Prabhupada gives. A man wants to make an appointment to meet a big somebody, a businessman. So before you can go meet the businessman, you have to have some credential. That's a big guy. And then you have to make an appointment with the secretary. Okay, so you got those two things. You got some credentials, some reason to see the big guy, you make an appointment with the secretary, and you go and sit down. And the secretary says, Mr. Big Guy is real busy right now, but if you wait, he'll be with you shortly. So he waits and he waits. So much time passes, the guy waiting out in the office gets restless. So when the secretary disappears from the desk, he goes right inside to the man's office and he sees there he is on the floor on his hands and knees with his son riding on his back playing horsey. Saying, "Giddy up!" Slaps his father. Rear end, you know. "Let's go." That's confidential. So from a distance, he's a big man. And confidential, he's horsey. He's my daddy. So that's confidential. One is seeing with awe and reverence. It's like this presentation that I'm making at colleges, going through the, in a kind of indirect way, but there's the five primary rasas. There's neutrality. Then there's service. And then there's friendship. Service is more than neutrality, because neutrality is awe and reverence. But it's passive. It's not, you don't do anything. But if then you, but you do something, you do some service, then it enters into the realm of servitude, love and service. And as that service becomes more and more confidential or intimate or deeply personal, it becomes friendship. But in Krishna's pastimes, he even, like his servants, they're confidential. In Vrindavan, there's a Daruka. He comes every morning and wakes Krishna up. It helps Mother Yasoda dress Krishna in the morning. That's very confidential. But he's just in lotus service. And in Dwaraka, there's another Daruka, it's not the same one, but he's Krishna's chariot driver. So when Krishna wants to go somewhere, he's ready. That's his service. So he's very intimately connected with Krishna, even in the mood of service, and then friendship. He knows a lot about that, like the chauffeur knows a lot about the man who he's driving the car for. He's just, you know, like a very close family member almost. Although his job is, he's the chauffeur, the servant. So they're intimately connected. So the confidential devotees know about the confidential pastimes of Krishna, whereas the there are portions of the same language is used in Brihad Bhagavatamrita about portions of there's some of the Upanishads are very formal, as if the person who wrote them is very formal. Some are less formal, some are very confidential. Gopal Tapani Upanishad is one of them, where it directly describes Krishna and the pastimes of Krishna, right in the Upanishads. Very confidential.
Kaluga has passed 5,000 years. already there is hardly any government who do anything according to their religious codes. It's there, even if concurs with religious codes, because it benefits them or it's easy for them, not because of religious codes. So given that things are always that bad, still 420,000 plus years are left for Kalyuga.
You mean it's going to get worse?
I mean, how far away is it going to get that far?
It's described in the 11th canto, how far it gets. What Prabhupada described is there's this golden age within the iron age, that the golden age is the golden avatar, the period of the Sankirtan of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And that's reversing, at least for persons who take shelter, it's reversing, and for those who don't take shelter, it's still giving benefit. Because wherever Sankirtan is taking place, the world receives benefit. But after that 10,000 year period, it's like a cliff. We're not at the cliff yet. Just 500 years into another 9,500 years. But at least those that take shelter can get relief and can experience like a golden age within the iron age. But after, Prabhupada describes that devotees will go to live in caves because it becomes so crazy. Go live in the forest, but even the forests are going to be chopped down and exploited. On that basis, Prabhupada said, best if you finish up your business in this life, don't come back with your unfinished business to complete it. Because it doesn't get easier. As Kali Yuga advances, it gets more difficult, more difficult, more difficult. I used to listen to that lecture every day before going. I would sit in the parking lot to distribute books at the airport and listen to that lecture again and again and again and again, what he would describe. Don't think. He gave the explanation that some persons don't like the idea of reincarnation. Some Christians don't like the idea of reincarnation because it says to them, oh, it's not one time only. So you don't have to be so serious. You can finish up what you don't finish next life. It's like, you know, at the university. If I don't have to take my exam at a certain time and I have the option to take it later, I'll take it later. But it's not that it makes one lazy, it makes one very responsible. Whatever I do, I'm responsible for it. And for those that are on the path of devotion, knowing that Kali Yuga is progressing and progressing, we can see it happening, like, so fast it's happening. I could tell some stories how fast it's happening. And that it continues to degrade, even during. So, but those who take shelter can get relief from it. But if we don't finish our business, we have to take birth again. So many times more degraded. It's not going to be easier. We have no idea where we're going to be born, what the circumstances, what government, what standards. Finish up business now. That's the impetus. And take as many with you as you can. Get on board, come on. Yes?
Like the ladies of Astana who are glorifying Krishna. Mentioned the first time they were seeing Krishna, but they had so much affection for Krishna.
Yeah, from
so
hearing. like Rukmini. She gave her life to Krishna. And she, her letter to Krishna said, if you don't accept me, that's okay. Millions of lifetimes I'll wait until you accept me. Because I've given my heart to you and to no other. I mean, it's like, you know, great romance kind of a line, but it was true. It was absolutely true. She had never seen Krishna. But that was her level of commitment. Pure devotion. Just from hearing about Krishna. Now she was not an ordinary living entity like we are. Going to our acharyas, direct expansion of Srimati Radharani. Okay. She's naturally attracted to Krishna. But so are we, because we're part and parcel of Krishna. We have a natural attraction to Krishna. That's covered by ignorance.
Elaborate more on
Sure.
Special reference to fledgling devotees.
What was the last part?
Initiated, like who have just begun. I'm saying fledgling devotees.
Just beginning to practice.
Yeah.
You want some inspiration? You want some tips? You want some methods? What do you want?
Complete package.
Complete package, come to one of our retreats. Or listen to the recordings. We just finished one, and I believe they were put online. They were put online? Recordings of the Japa retreat. So with, like, in the beginning, the chanting is often seen as a means to some other end. I want relief, and I get relief. I want to be more peaceful. I was meaning to share this with you in the car today. Just as soon as I got in the car, I started chanting. It was so nice just to chant. Because the things that I was doing before were hurried, and conference calls and stressful things and management, just to be able to sit and chant Krishna's holy name, so sublime. It's just not like a de-stressor, but it's sublime, joyful. So it's not a mean, but it's not just a means to that end, to become joyful. I was considering it's Krishna making himself available, accessible, like Mahaprabhu describes. Nam namakari bahudan dija sarvashakis. You have nam namakari, you have bahuda. There's so many names. And you make yourself accessible through each and every one of these names, and you have vested all of your transcendental potencies in every one of your names. Krishna's, you know, what qualification do we have? We're disqualified. That's our qualification. We're fallen. We have no qualification, but Krishna's so kind. So we can immediately, so what in the beginning stage is to recognize it's chanting is not like a club to beat away, you know, the problems that you have. It's the association with Krishna. It's Krishna's present in that sound vibration. So to realize that, I could say try to realize that, but to realize that, be present. That's a very simple phrase, be present. Like when you're with somebody, be present. So when that we're having this little, you know, dialogue. If I was just not paying much attention, and that was a nice question. I'll think about it. It's not very warm, is it? Not very inviting. But be present with Krishna. That's a very simple meditation that I've been acting on for some time, like a few months. When chanting, be present with Krishna. Krishna's, you're inviting, you're calling Krishna, and Krishna comes. Be present with him. And when you're present with Krishna, what happens? Well, because we're beginners, we don't feel too much. But the process is, it's likened to, in fact it is, awakening that seed-like, that which is in a seed-like condition, sprouts. Like a seed sprouts. So you could have in your cabinet there, you know, a bag of mung dal, or a jar of mung dal. But you could sprout that mung dal too, right? You have to have the right conditions. And then it doesn't, like, you know, as soon as you put it in the water, poof, it's a sprout. It takes some time. So the seed that's in the heart of, in the mature stage of love of God, the sprouting of that seed is to be present with the holy name. The watering of that seed, giving water and giving light to the seed, makes it sprout. So that's what you're doing when you're chanting. Think of those two things. You're being present with Krishna, and it's a sprouting process, an awakening of something that's already there, not something that's out there, or something that's here. It's something that's here. It's already there. So very patiently, I can just go on chanting, and chanting, and chanting, and chanting. And I don't have an expectation from Krishna. He's got to do something. That's the fruitive. But Krishna is very kind. He's allowing me to be present with him, like these, you know, the ladies. There he goes. He's showing his form to us. He who is, think of what Krishna is. That's nice. But even if you aren't so much in detail deliberating upon what Krishna is, just the Supreme Personality of God, and he's making himself accessible. And by that presence with Krishna, my dormant consciousness, spiritual consciousness, is being awakened in a very natural way. All I have to do is be present. And, you know, that means don't be absent. Don't be, you know.
Yeah, that was a nice question. I don't think about it.
Don't do that. Be present with Krishna. And appreciate that it's awakening. It's nice very beneficial, more than nice, to chant the holy name in the association of devotees, sincere devotees. Just because you're asking this question, my thoughts are going to this experience that we had 2 weekends ago at Gita Nagari. With after the Japa retreat, there was a group of students from Penn State that came for another event. We called it Mantra Yoga Retreat. Somehow the organization on campus got, you know, a permission to have a big banner right across the main arch that goes into the campus. Mantra Yoga Retreat. Wow, they really scored somehow. So a lot of people, a number of people signed up, registered, and came. They didn't know it was Hare Krishna Temple, a project. They just thought it was, you know, a rural community in about an hour from State College. And they just saw yoga. So they came, you know, and bring your yoga mat. They came for hatha yoga. So we had our orientation on Friday night. And because the banner said mantra yoga, we were doing mantra yoga. And they didn't want mantra yoga. They wanted hatha yoga. And so they were looking around at each other like, and the vibration was building like, what's going on here? I found out later one turned to another and said, is this about God? So there was some negativity. We started on a negativity note. Then we're, you know, came to chant to experience love of God. They came to do hatha yoga. So, little discussion, and we just completely changed the whole plan. So somebody there was a yoga instructor, was one of the devotees, you know, by design. And so, Saturday morning, hatha yoga, before breakfast. And after breakfast, some stretching and, you know, some more, you know, that he called it vinyasa yoga, which is, there's yoga where you hold a pose and there's yoga where you're removing, like Surya Namaskar. It's just continuous movement. And slowly, they were liking what they were doing because that's what they came for. And the atmosphere was great, and the peacocks, and, you know, it was a nice place to get around with cows and trees. So, after lunch, it was pranayam. And after pranayam, towards the end, it was, okay, now we're going to experience after you're breathing in. Breathing in and exhale, and on the exhale we're going to chant Om. And we're going to make this ocean of Om. The ocean of Om. They really like the ocean of Om. They were very relaxed. They were very happy. And they understood something about the role of this sound vibration to enhance your yoga, to focus the mind and purify the mind. So then the next thing was a little PowerPoint on the power of sound. What does sound do? Sound can move matter. Sound can break glass. Sound can kill people. Sound can cure people through medicine. Sound can take things out of the body in medicine. Sound can move matter. Sound can move the mind. Sound can move the heart. And then, okay, now a little experience. You're going to experience how sound affects the body. And then there's different, there's material sounds, and then there's motive goodness sounds, and then there's spiritual sounds. And you can feel the difference. And then, japa. Break. Prasadam. And that was in the evening, was then kirtan yoga. which they had, same thing they did on Friday evening, was now Saturday evening. But they were very open, and it started, you know, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudeva, just singing very melodiously. Then Govinda Jaya Jaya, Gopala Jaya Jaya, Radha Ramana Hari Govinda Jaya Jaya. Then singing and singing and singing. It was started slowly and started getting lively, and they looked at each other. They had never seen devotees dance before, but they just got up and started dancing. And dancing, and they were like little children and peacocks, dancing and dancing and around, and just like devotees do, dancing around and around. Around the whole circle, and then, you know, with each other, and Badahari then started chanting Hare Krishna. They kept dancing and dancing and dancing and dancing. And then when it was over, they were going, more, more, more. So he said, okay, we'll do one more. He sat down. It was very mellow, very, very calming melody, very sweet melody. And it stayed slow. It didn't get fast tempo. It just stayed slow. At the end, it was, you know, a full minute of applause. I was so happy. And the sharing the next day was just amazing. You know, what was your experience and what do you plan to take home with you? They were sharing. I found this sacred space inside myself that, you know, one girl said, black girl said, I have an anger problem. Not a real bad one, like anger management, but something happens and it just like gets a hold of my mind and my mind won't let go, and I think about the thing, it just gets bigger and bigger, and everyone was nodding. And you know, I just get stuck on that thing and I don't like the way I feel, and I know it's not right, but but now I know what to do. I'm just going to set that aside and go within myself and take these yoga practices and mantra chanting and find that sacred space inside. Then I can deal with whatever that thing is, but I'll be in a very, very different space, and I'm really grateful. It's powerful. You know, I can give other how others send me. But it was... They didn't come with an expectation for, you know, anything other than Hatha Yoga. But through association of very elevated souls and chanting the holy name, they experienced something they had never experienced before. So, the third item is chant with devotees. If you, you know, as much as your schedule permits, it may take some time to go out of your way to go and sit with the devotees instead of just chanting alone. But if you can do that, I don't know logistically if that's possible, but at least on weekends or something, chant together, and it's it would enhance your chanting. You listen to those recordings and you'll find many things. It's instructions from our acharyas, Bhaktivinoda Thakur's advice, and Sanatana Goswami's advice from Hari Bhakti Vilas, other devotees that, you know, contemporary devotees that for 35 years have been chanting. And they're very simple points. Another one is one mantra at a time. Don't worry about the last mantra that you didn't chant so well, the last two rounds that you didn't chant so well, or the ones that you're going to chant, you're not sure you're ready to do them better. You can't chant those future rounds now. You can chant this one now. So be present. It's another way of saying be present with the holy name. One mantra at a time. 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 And you get absorbed in that mantra which you're chanting, and time passes very quickly. Like it changes from the counting game, when am I going to be done because I've got some other things to do. It becomes the experience of being present with Krishna in the form of His holy name. Experience that purity, that relationship, that awakening of the seed of devotion that's within everybody. But through mercy, especially the mercy of the holy name, it comes out. It's a whole other picture. Maybe we should end. That's a good place to end. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. I brought some Mahaprasadam. I'm going to go get it. And there's several of them. I'll be right back.